Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
This is the Golden Age of Radio, WTIC's monthly program of radio nostalgia. And here to introduce our guest for this evening is the host of the Golden Age of Radio, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me is radio collector Ed Corcoran to introduce tonight's guest.
Again, Dick, we have another very famous radio actor, and one who is maybe more familiar to daytime TV viewers because he's been on Search for Tomorrow for some 23 years. He plays the character of Stu Bergman, and it's my very great pleasure to introduce to you, Dick, Larry Haynes.
Larry, it's a pleasure to have you here on the program.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
How's the gas situation over at Westside Auto Parts?
Well, we haven't been struck yet. I don't think there's been any mention of it. We have mentioned a fuel shortage in the storyline in respect to my trying to sell my house, which I'm trying to discourage people from doing because I'm so attached to it. And we had some people on one episode come in to look at the house, and I was trying to dissuade them from buying it and reminding them that there would be a fuel shortage.
Well, good. You have to keep current, certainly, in the soaps, I'm
sure.
Well,
we try. We try. We're pretty current.
You know, I was very familiar with the show for a long time because I was assigned to the booth during the time that it was on the air. So I would do the station breaks around the show.
Oh.
But I've lost track of it, and I know now that you're a widower, and unfortunately that's as a result of the actress who portrayed your wife.
Yeah, Mel Barret. Yeah, she did. And that was a tragic thing, and it was a tremendous blow to all of us. You know, we were very good friends aside from working companions, but I think the producers very wisely decided that Melba could not be replaced, that the audience would not accept someone else playing the role of Marge after she had played it for 19 or 20 years. And so they incorporated her death into the actual storyline, which I thought was wise. And from the mail we've received, I think the audiences approved of it.
Mm.
They didn't want to see someone else playing Marge. She was such a strong character and such a likable character. So Stu is a widower.
Yeah, that happened in the radio. And remember back when Barton Yarborough passed away?
Yeah.
He was on the Dragnet. He played Ben Romero. And then they said he had a heart attack. And then he was replaced by, eventually, Frank Smith.
You know, you were talking about likable characters. Mm. When I first saw you on Search for Tomorrow, I couldn't believe that you were so likable. Because you were the greatest villain. You were the greatest villain, as far as I was concerned, as a radio listener that ever was behind a microphone.
Yeah.
You were the heavy on just about every show that came down the pike, weren't you?
Well, I tell you, it's a funny thing, Dick. In each medium, they look for different things. Physically, no one ever thought of me as a heavy on stage. I do play a heavy in a visual medium, namely motion pictures, and the film that's about to come out, which I'll tell you about later. But it had been difficult for me to impress upon people that I played heavies in radio, and they looked at me and said, "No, come on now, you're much too cherubic." And So I made a transition from playing heavies to doing comedy, which I always loved doing anyway, and I still do, and I played some of it in radio. And now I'm known as a light comedian in theater, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it must be more satisfying, certainly, to be known as an all-around flexible actor rather than to be typecast, as I guess most actors, many actors, tended to be in radio, weren't they?
Well,
easy to work with a voice. You knew this vocal quality, and so you said, "Well, let's have Haynes."
Give me a Larry Haynes type if you can't get Larry Haynes.
Well, that was always, give me a Frank Lovejoy or give me someone else. But there was a period where they never thought of me for anything but heavies, even in radio, until the latter part of my career in radio. And I was I made the transition to romantic leads, and nobody believed I could do it until I proved that I could.
Did you change your vocal quality when you did heavies? Suppose you were doing one now, would you talk somewhat differently than you did?
Well, you just gruff them up a little bit, and you make them a little more guttural and less polished, and you got a heavy.
Yeah.
Want to play romantic? You can talk like that.
Soften up a little bit.
Larry, let's go back to the beginnings for you. Back to 1939 and an interview at CBS.
That was my dear old friend, whom I shall never forget, Marge Morrow, who was in charge of casting for all the dramatic shows at CBS in New York. And I applied for an audition, and Marge auditioned me and asked me if I had ever done any radio, and I said no. Actually, I'd come to CBS directly from college. And after my audition, she thought that I should learn the medium because there is a definite technique in radio acting.
Mm-hmm.
And she suggested I audition for the NYA, which was then known as National Youth Administration. They had many facets, one of which was a school of radio. And so I did, and I passed the audition, and I stayed there for about a year. And we got a fast $25 a month.
And, but they did pay you.
But they did pay us, yes. Then I went out to a station called WWRL out in Woodside, Long Island. Then after a year and a half or so, when I felt that I knew the medium well enough, I reapplied at CBS, auditioned again, and I was cast on a show called Man Behind the Gun, which became very prominent, very popular, and won the Peabody Award several times. And then the ball started rolling.
And that program that you just mentioned, Man Behind the Gun, was probably one of the highlights of radio drama, wouldn't you say, Ed?
Yes, remember we had Jackson Beck on the show, and he talked about the number of sound men they had, and the whole production was very lavish and never been duplicated.
It's unbelievable to think that a half-hour radio show would rehearse 8 to 12 hours, and most of it was to coordinate sound. And we had, as I recall, 4 turntables, 3 sound men. The whole studio was primarily taken up with sound effects. And Bill Robeson, William N. Robeson, who produced and directed the show then, was meticulous about sound. I mean, just cut a syllable in half with a machine gun. And this took a lot of explicit timing, and it was very involved, but the overall effect was fantastic. I don't think there's ever been a radio show that had as authentic and precise sound effects as Man Behind the Gun did.
The Columbia Broadcasting System presents The Man Behind the Gun, dedicated to the fighting forces of the United States and the United Nations, and broadcast in the hope that these authentic accounts of men at war will bring you a better understanding and deeper appreciation of the job our fighting men are doing on every battlefront in the world, and the job we have to do to back their attack with extra war bonds.
That was the familiar opening to The Man Behind the Gun. Now, in the excerpt that we're going to hear tonight, you're in a submarine somewhere in the Pacific. Jackson Beck is the narrator in this story. The lead is played by Frank Lovejoy. And as we join the episode, the skipper, Frank Lovejoy, is shouting orders to the torpedo crew.
Stand by, all ahead slow. Right rudder to 335 degrees. Give me a time check.
1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds.
The submarine turns now and everybody is quiet. The moisture drips down from the plates and sounds like thunder when it hits your head. Your stomach aches again, and the sound of the motors is an intolerable whine. And you stand there waiting for orders while the officers time the slow swing of the sub as it turns into firing position.
Stand by to fire.
Standing by, sir.
Steadying up on 335, sir.
20, 29, 30. Fire one.
Number one fired electrically.
Fire three.
Number three, fired electrically.
Fire five.
Number five, fired electrically.
Out the seconds, quartermaster.
Aye, aye, sir. Coming up on 15 seconds.
Should take about 30 seconds for that first one to hit at this range.
You'll soon know.
20 seconds. 25 seconds. 30 seconds. 35 seconds.
Missed him with number one.
40 seconds.
Got him. Got him with number three. Down 100 feet.
Diver!
Over now. You're down 100 feet, and suddenly you're sick. Your mouth is sweating inside, and you swallow convulsively. The dials in front of you are playing leapfrog. You shake your head, and little black minnows swim back and forth against the whiteness of the dive meter. And there's a bonfire in your stomach.
What's the matter with that man?
He's faded, sir.
Put somebody on the wheel. Leave him there. We can't bother with him now. That destroyer will be on top of us in a minute.
Yes, sir.
Look alive.
Their voices are dim and far away, and the light is in your eyes. You're tired, more tired than you've ever been in your life. And your body is gone. Only your brain is left. You can't feel anything, only see and hear. And you hear the depth charges.
Cut both motors.
Cutting both, sir.
Sub is settling down in the water. Its forward speed is gone, and like an aeroplane, it glides forward and down, away from the destroyer.
Start both at 200 feet, Mr. Slocum.
Aye, aye, sir.
Take a look at Quinn. See what's the matter with him.
I'm all right now.
You don't look all right. What's the matter with you?
You must have fainted, sir.
You sure picked a fine time for it.
Sorry, sir.
Pardon me, sir. He hasn't eaten hardly anything for a week. I think he's sick, sir.
Two of you men take him forward and put him in my bunk. Tell the pharmacist mate to give him the once over.
200 feet, sir.
All ahead, full.
They take him forward through the narrow passageway and put him in the captain's bunk. Then Latimer, the pharmacist's mate, comes in.
What's the trouble, kid?
I don't know.
Well, let's take a look.
Your name is Latimer. You've been in the submarine service a long time. You're a pharmacist's mate, a pill roller. A guy gets a bellyache and you hand him a pill. He gets a cold, you hand him a pill. He has a headache, a pill. But this is different. This boy's face is green, and his skin is hot under your hand. Cautiously, you touch him with one finger to the right and below the navel.
Holy. What's the matter? What's the matter with me, Latimer?
He stares up at you, pleading with you. You can't look into his eyes. You swallow a couple of times and lick your lips and then turn away toward the control room.
Be right back, kid. Take it easy.
You stumble over the combing in your haste. The palms of your hands are suddenly dry and cold. And you stand there by the forward periscope waiting for the captain to notice you. And your mouth is like cotton.
What's the matter with him, Latimer? Find anything?
Listen, I'm no doctor. All I'm supposed to do is put on bandages and hand out pills. I'm no doctor.
Okay. So what?
Well, I don't know. I can't say for sure. I can say for sure, but I don't know what to do about it. It's out of my line. He's got to have an operation right away, or he's a dead duck.
An operation? For what? What's he got?
Appendicitis, I'll swear to it.
Appendicitis? 2,000 miles from a doctor with a Jap destroyer running up and down overhead like a kid on a scooter dropping marbles, and he has to go and get appendicitis.
This was one of the best series dealing with World War II. They were authentic. We did Guadalcanal, we did D-Day, we did the bombings, and they were all authentic occurrences. There was no fiction involved at all, which is another reason it was so fantastic.
Our guest tonight on The Golden Age of Radio is actor Larry Haynes, and we're talking about some of those golden years. Once the door had been opened for you, once Larry Haynes was known by the producers of radio shows, did they call you or did you call them? In other words, did you have to do a lot of auditioning for work?
No. Once you were established, as most of the names who are familiar to you, you were called. The producer or director would read a script and say vocally, Larry Haynes is right, or Dick is right, or so-and-so is right, and that's the way they would cast it. Once in a while, they would hold auditions, but very rarely would a show like Gangbusters or Inner Sanctum or any of those audition people for parts. No, it was very tough, unfortunately, for people to break into radio who were not known. And their entree pretty much were the sustaining shows, which are the shows that the networks produced that were non-commercial. And that was their entree to radio.
Sure. Now, the one thing about radio, which is different than television, was that you had a certain anonymity, I believe is the word, where you could be on 10 shows a day and walk down Broadway in 42nd, and nobody would recognize you. Did anybody ever recognize you because of your voice?
Yes.
You know, in social?
As a matter of fact, quite recently, I was amazed, shocked. I almost forgot what I was doing. I was placing a call at a booth, and I dialed the operator and asked for a number, and she said, yes, just one moment, Mr. Haynes.
No fool.
I almost fell wrong.
I would have been less surprised if she had said, Mr. Bergman.
Well, apparently she was an old radio fan.
Yeah, I guess so.
But that amazed me. That really amazed me.
Did you do many shows before a live audience?
Mm-hmm.
And if so, what was the difference between the live audience show and the studio show?
Well, there was no difference, except that I remember doing Philip Morris Playhouse with some regularity, and that was directed by Charlie Morton, produced by Charlie, and we did it at the CBS studios on Broadway in about 53rd, where the Ed Sullivan Theater was. It still is the Ed Sullivan Theater, but that's where we did Prudential. And Philip Morris Playhouse, and there was an invited audience, and it is quite a big theater, and I never could understand why anyone would go out of his way to sit in a theater to watch actors standing around a microphone, because that's as much action as you're going to get. I tell you, Dick, it at times was a distraction in this respect. If there were a sound effect like a gun fired, invariably there would be several in the audience who would laugh or gasp and react vocally, and it would just ruin the dramatization completely. In that respect, I always felt it was a deterrent factor. For comedy shows like the Milton Berle show, the old Jimmy Durante show, they were fine. They would enhance the broadcast. But I never really could understand having a live audience at a dramatic show. But
Cavalcade of America was a perfect
They were there,
example
but I think they
that,
were there to see the celebrities.
Yeah, I
you
suppose.
Know, that was the only attraction.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes you had these sound people who did it with their voice. They'd imitate a baby or imitate something out of the ordinary. And, in a drama, that might appear very funny if you're not used to that.
We had a charming old gentleman named Donald Bain in the early days of radio who used to do just what you're talking about. He would do dogs and any animal you wanted. He could do very well, reproduce very well, and he was very meticulous about it, and he was quite a character. And as a matter of fact, that reminds me of the day he was called in on Man Behind the Gun when we're doing one of the Guadalcanal things, and Frank Lovejoy and I were playing a scene in a foxhole, and the director wanted the sound of a mosquito on cue. And it was part of the.
I don't believe it, but
it was part of the scene. The line of dialogue ran something like Frank saying, "Oh darn, that mosquito," and he would slap himself on the cheek, and that would be the end of the mosquito. Well, Donald Dane was called in to do this mosquito, and he came in and reproduced it beautifully. And Frank said, "Darn that mosquito," and he slapped his face, and Donald Bain did a death scene of a mosquito. He went, zzz, 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 zzz. Well, we We thought he was kidding, but he wasn't. He was so meticulous about his work. You know, if you would say, do a German Shepherd, he would say, male or female. And I kid you not, really. Fabulous character.
Were you able to hold together?
He did a death scene with a mosquito. We all fell on the floor, you know.
I can imagine.
Convulsed.
All right. I'd like to hear Larry at work. What show do you think we might play here, Ed?
Well, I have one from early in his career, which is the only copy in the United States, Dick. I got this from Jay Hickerson, a collector down in New Haven. It's Crime Doctor, and this goes back to very early in your career, I would say.
When I was 12.
Yes,
that's
right.
What I sound like.
You're
playing
a juvenile lead. And in the cast are Edgar Staley,
among others,
and who recently passed away.
Yes, unfortunately.
And, who we all remember is Dr. Ewer.
Yeah.
And I believe Ralph Bell is also in this.
Yeah, I just worked with Ralph 2 weeks ago on this.
So this is an old home week for you.
Yeah, and Jackson.
So shall we reminisce and hear it, Larry?
Well, I'd love to.
Halt! Halt, about you!
Johnny presents Crime Doctor. Here comes Johnny, ladies and gentlemen, in his red coat and brass buttons. Johnny, stepping out of store windows and counters all over America to introduce the Crime Doctor program to all you people at home, as well as our men and women in service, wherever this program reaches them. And now another of Max Morrison's Crime Doctor dramas.
What are you doing, Jean?
Mixing Mr. Albertson's medicine. I heard him come in.
Yeah, I just brought him back. Yeah, I'm getting sick of driving that old bird around. No matter how I drive the car, it ain't right. If I drive slow, I get bawled out for crawling along. If I go fast, I get called down for speeding.
Well, the doctor said he must be driven carefully and avoid any jolting to him.
I sure could have given him a jolt in the eye this afternoon. You know what he said to me? He said if it wasn't for my wife, he'd fire me today. So now I'm holding down my job because you're working for him.
Look, Bob, we don't have to work in the same place. If you don't like it here, why don't you find yourself another job?
Well, look, baby, the war will be over soon. There'll be plenty of chauffeurs around looking for jobs. Besides, we've worked in the same places together since we were married, and that's how it's going to stay.
Jean. Jean.
Yes, sir, I'll be right in. Calling for his medicine. I've got to go.
Didn't Bob tell you I was back?
Yes, sir. It took me a few moments to mix the medicine.
Oh.
Ready for it?
Oh, I'm never ready to swallow the darn stuff.
Oh, come on now. You know you've got to take it. Here.
Oh, well.
Oh.
You should be used to it by now.
You try taking it for a year. Doesn't get any better with time. I'm wondering, too, if it really is doing me any good.
Well, you haven't had an attack in nearly a month now.
Jean, I've been waiting to ask you something, Jean. I don't think Bob's very happy here. I'm sure he's not good for me. His driving makes me nervous. I was wondering, if I decided to let him go, would you feel that you had to leave with him?
No, sir. I like it here.
Thank you, Jean. I'm very pleased to hear that.
Come on, get in here.
All right,
come on, get in there.
Shove me, leave me alone.
Don't argue with me. You
can't lock me up.
Get in there.
All right.
What's the matter, Riley? Drunk and disorderly.
Sergeant, this is an outrage. A man's got a right to go see his own wife without having the door slammed in his place. That's what she's done to me. That's just what she's done.
What did he do? Threw a brick through the window and she wouldn't let him in. What's your name, mister?
What do you want to know for?
I'm signing you in for the night.
Excuse me, Mr. Albertson.
Yes, Jean?
That lawyer who telephoned is here.
Well, ask him to come in.
Will you come in, Mr. Moran?
Well, thank you.
Oh, don't go, Jean.
Yes, sir.
I presume you're Mr. Albertson?
Yes.
I represent Mr. Mason, this young lady's husband.
Yes. Well, I don't understand, Mr. Moran, why my husband should want you to see Mr. Albertson.
Well, my client believes he has some sort of a grievance against Mr. Albertson. He feels that he's responsible for breaking up his home.
Bob broke it himself by his own conduct.
That would be for a court to determine. Mr. Mason is suffering great anguish of mind. And if Mr. Albertson is in any wise responsible...
Look, Moran, I consented to see you because I thought I might help to straighten out a situation between Jean and her husband. Jean tells me she will not live with him again. She intends to obtain a divorce.
Yes, so I understand. And my client feels, Mr. Albertson, that you have persuaded her to take the step.
That's not true.
I've interested myself in this matter, Mr. Moran, for purely selfish reasons. Mrs. Mason has no evidence with which to obtain a divorce in this state. I told her that. She insists that she'll go to some other state to obtain it, but she's my nurse and I can't spare her. I told her if she could arrange with her husband for him to obtain the divorce in another state...
Yes.
I'd be willing to pay his expenses and, in addition, give him a sum of money.
Well, Mr. Albertson, that seems like a reasonable suggestion. I'll talk it over with my client.
$3,000. $3,000, is that all you could get out of him, Archie?
Yes, Bob, yes. He says that includes the divorce expenses.
What the old cheapskate.
Well, you better take it, Bob. I got his check. I'll cash it and we'll split it. $1,500 for you, $1,500 for me.
Where do you come in for half?
Look, I could get into a bad jam going up there and posing as a lawyer. I took a big chance.
Maybe I should have got a real lawyer.
No lawyer could do for you what I'm going to do if you sit tight and follow what I tell you. You're not going to Reno and you're not going to get any divorce. You're going to lay low for 6 weeks. And if things happen as I think they will, brother, we're both going to be in the big dog.
Yes?
I'm back from Reno, Jean. I suppose you'll be glad to hear I've got the divorce.
Thank you, Bob. It was nice of you to phone me. What are your plans?
Oh, I've got my plans. Don't worry about me. Goodbye.
Who was it, Jean?
Bob called me. He's back from Reno. He got the divorce. I'm free.
I'm glad to hear it, my dear. Now I feel free to speak to you.
Yes?
I've grown very fond of you, Jean. I know I'm much older than you, but... I hope you've grown to like me a little.
I like you a lot, Mr. Albertson.
I'd like to feel that we could be together always. Do you think you care enough for me to be my wife?
Hey, Bob.
Huh?
Bob, you see the paper?
What?
Look, there it is. They were married, all right. I told you they'd do it.
They didn't waste any time.
No. Hey, where's that phony divorce decree you took up to show her?
Oh, I got it.
Well, let me have it.
Oh, I'm going to tear it up right here and now and fling the pieces out the window. Oh, boy, are we sitting pretty.
Our guest tonight on the Golden Age of Radio is Larry Haynes. This is Dick Bertel along with Ed Corcoran, and let's recall more of those golden years. You weren't always a heavy, Larry, because you were the star of Treasury Agent.
Yeah, and I was the good guy there.
He was a good guy, right?
Yeah. Al Lincoln was my name, the name of the character. And that was a series to deal with T-Men problems. And Lawson Zerbe played my sidekick.
Was that on the network, on the Mutual Network?
Yeah, that was on the Mutual Network.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same director, Leonard Bass, used to do Gangbusters and Counter Spy. And it was a Phillips H. Lord production. Phil Lord did Gangbusters. He started Gangbusters, as a matter of fact, created it. And he came up with this Treasury Agent format, and it was a very, very nice show to do. It was fun.
You struck a nerve when you mentioned Phillips H. Lord, because we always like to hear people's opinion. He was certainly one of the most controversial figures in radio, and...
Well,
what was your
when I first met Mr. Lord, he had me come up to his office. I had never done a Gangbusters show, but he had heard of me from the other things I had done in radio. And Phil Lord was the only man I know of who would cast visually for radio. So someone tipped me off and said, Larry, when you walk into Phil Lord's office, have a cigarette drooping out of the corner of your mouth. Look as tough as you can, otherwise he won't cast you as a heavy for radio. And he was the only man I knew of who would look at people and say, no, he doesn't look like he could play a gangster.
law enforcement agencies of the United States Treasury constitute the largest group of its kind in the world. 64% of all criminals in federal penitentiaries are apprehended by the 3,000 special agents of the United States Treasury.
Based on actual cases investigated and closed by the United States Treasury Department, the Mutual Broadcasting System presents Treasury Agent.
United States Treasury Enforcement Agencies.
Secret Service.
Protects our president. Protects our money and securities from counterfeiting.
Intelligence Division.
Jurisdiction over tax frauds and evasion.
Bureau of Customs. Bureau of Narcotics. Alcohol and Tobacco Tax Division. Coast Guard. Crimes committed on the high seas.
United States Treasury. Largest group of law enforcement agencies in the world. Each week at this same time, Mutual proudly transcribes Treasury Agent, based on the activities of Treasury agents operating here and all over the world. When the facts are all in, it's really very simple. For good mystery, stay tuned to Mutual. Throughout the week, you'll find top-drawer mystery drama of the kind and type you like best. If you prefer stories involving a favorite sleuth, built around his continuing exploits in the field of crime detection, you can hear Broadway Cop, featuring Lou Riley, who's an unofficial aide to the regular police force. Or there's John Steele, adventurer, as a globe-circling wayfarer, Lieutenant Dan Britt, unofficial detective, and David Harding as an ace government counter-spy. For authentic and factual drama, you can listen to top-secret files revealing intrigue on the highest levels, while Squad Room and Crime Fighters each turns the spotlight on the machinery of law at work. And for mystery that's definitely different, Sentenced brings you the story of how modern electronic brains are used in the battle against crime. Those are the facts. For mystery, make it Mutual. Hear them all every week over most of these stations. And now, Treasury Agent and Treasury Agent Joe Lincoln.
I often wonder if the real menace of counterfeiting money is fully understood. We have faith in our money because it's always accepted at face value. But if enough of it is counterfeit, our entire system of currency could be undermined. Therefore, Treasury agents move quickly even on cases involving relatively small amounts of counterfeit. Let me take you first to a shabby barroom on Chicago's South Side.
Hey, Matt.
Yes?
Give me a blend and plain water.
All right, coming right up. Here you are. That'll be a quarter.
Hey, look, Mike, I haven't got a nickel and change. Can you break this?
It's a 20.
Can you break it?
Well, I'll have to ask the boss if he's got change. Just a second. Boss. Hey, boss.
Yeah?
Well, here's another one, boss. Another 20. And it don't look right to me.
Murphy, what did I tell you?
Mr. Schmidt, look at them bulletins, then look at this bill. It's from the same guy that gave me the first one. The guy unloads two here in half an hour.
Murphy, I said for you to stay behind the bar or I'll stick my finger in your eye.
Please, let me phone the cops, boss. Quick, while the guy is still here.
Ah, if you didn't make such good drinks, I'd fire you, Murphy. All right, go ahead, call.
United States Treasury, Washington. TT forwarded from Agent Spencer, District Office, Chicago. Two counterfeit $20 bills located in Southside Tavern. May be part of large counterfeit passing operation. Request your assistance in pursuing investigation further.
Here are the bills, Lincoln.
Mm-hmm. Take a look, Al.
Yeah.
Hey, Al. Andrew Jackson is a little cross-eyed.
What?
You see, Spencer? These bills were made by Lustig.
Count Victor Lustig?
Mm-hmm.
We put him in jail years ago.
Yes, Al, and destroyed the plates, but every once in a while, bills made from them show up.
They catch the patsy.
Well, he got jumpy when the bartender went to the back of the place, but we've got a description of him.
Spencer, you reported he came back to that same bar twice inside of half an hour. Odd, isn't it?
We figure he must have been working the bars regularly and forgot he'd been in that one before.
Let's talk to that bartender.
Sure, Mr. Lincoln. Sure, I was leery of it. And Mr. Schmidt wouldn't believe me. But I was right. I was right, wasn't I?
Yes, you certainly were, Murphy. Ever see that man before?
No, but I got a pal across the street. He works for O'Toole's Fish House. They got a bar there, too. He says this guy's been in there.
Since the day he was in here?
Only yesterday, he said. I warned him before, but...
O'Toole's Fish House, huh? Maybe we ought to take a look at O'Toole's Fish House, Joe.
Al, you're always hungry.
Oh, not always. Only three times a day.
Yeah, and each time 6 hours long. Okay, let's start with O'Toole's. And if our boy's not at O'Toole's, you'll eat anything they have in a few other places.
Oh, Joe, this is the fourth place we've been in. I've eaten fish in O'Toole's, Gung Gung Fu Gung at Chin Lo's, apple pie and coffee at Ruggiero's Southside Gardens, family cuisine especially. I can't eat anymore, not for an hour anyway.
Hold it up. Spencer.
Yes?
Brown top coat, scraggly brown mustache, a drooping left eye. Take a look at that boy who just came in.
At the bar?
Mm-hmm.
I'm paying for a drink with a 20. Take him in for questioning, Joe?
Yeah. You on his right, Spencer, me on his left. Al behind him.
Let's go.
Well, Larry, during the heyday of radio acting, I assume that you did nothing else. Am I right in that assumption?
You are right, Dick. Time would prohibit you from doing anything else. As I said earlier, you would do 2, 3, sometimes 4 shows a day, 7 days a week, and that would take you into the early morning hours. I didn't do my first play on Broadway until, well after I had been in radio for about 15 years.
I want to ask you, was there one day, one moment when suddenly you realized that perhaps all of this might be coming to an end as far as radio acting is concerned? And where were you? Watching television in the bar somewhere?
Well, no, we saw the handwriting on the wall. I never could quite believe that television would replace radio dramatically. I thought it was well off into the future because of prohibitive costs of production, etc. And I was always hopeful that radio drama would remain. And unfortunately, we began to see the demise of radio as shows were lopped off like, a herd of cattle going to slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
And it got down to like 4 shows being left, and all of them were soap operas. And at the time, I was fortunate enough to have been involved in 2 of them, one of which was The Second Mrs. Burton, and the other was Rosemary. And then Rosemary went, and Second Mrs. Burton was one of the last to go. Ma Perkins, I think, was the longest running on radio.
Yeah, 27 mm-hmm. years. Yeah.
So I made the transition from radio to television, fortunately, by going into the first daytime, I hate to call them soap operas, daytime dramatic series called The First 100 Years. That was the very first daytime show in television. And I did that for about a year, year and a half, and then went right from that into Search for Tomorrow, where I've been for almost 23 years.
You're in a real rut.
But along with that, with television, I find a lot more freedom to do other things, which I have done.
Such as?
Well, I've done 5 or 6 hits on Broadway. The first one I did was A Thousand Clowns with Jason Robards and Sandy Dennis. And then I went into Promises, Promises, in which I played the doctor. And then I did Generation with Henry Fonda, in which I played another doctor. Then I most recently did Twigs with Seda Thompson. And I also replaced Jimmy Coco for 2 weeks in Last of the Red Hot Lovers. And in between all that, I did the movie version of The Odd Couple. So
and
I've kept busy.
Were you working around the Search for Tomorrow schedule? The show was live, I guess, up until just a few years ago.
The only involvement with the TV show, which was a contractual arrangement, was that they would write me out on Wednesday matinees. So I would not have to do Search on a Wednesday.
That's rather interesting. How much flexibility do they tend to give you as an actor on one of these soap operas?
Well, they give you a lot of flexibility if you give them enough time to adjust their story.
You know, usually these conversations, up until about 2 months ago, Ed, would always end up on the fact that our actor is now doing television and is quite successful and wishes that radio would one day return. Well, Larry, you don't have to wish anymore, do you?
No, as you know. As I told you before we started broadcasting, that Hi Brown, who used to do Inner Sanctum, I'm sure most of your radio fans remember Inner Sanctum, has revived radio, or is trying to, with a show called the CBS Radio Mystery Theater, I guess it is, which in format basically is kind of like the old Inner Sanctum shows. It's more believable now and less ethereal than it was as Inner Sanctum. And we're doing mystery shows. I've done two of them now. And I think they should catch on. I think there is a market for radio drama.
Is there any problem in adjusting to radio drama again?
I felt like I had never done a radio show in my life because it had been 15 years. And I went in with great trepidation and said, my goodness, you know, this I'm going to have a script in my hand now. How will I handle it? But it all came back, and it was fun. Boy, I really enjoyed it, and so do all of us who are from the old days, you know, Jackson Beck and Ralph Bell, and it was like an old class reunion. It was marvelous.
Have techniques changed? I'm talking technically as well as perhaps acting styles.
No, acting styles haven't changed. The technical end of broadcasting has changed a bit. Things are more electronic now than they were in the old days of radio. Most of your sound effects were done manually. And now they use cartridges. It's kind of a hard adjustment for us because we used to kind of time our dialogue with the sound effects man, and it was helpful.
Do you have a live manual sound effects man there as well?
Oh, yeah. You know, things like opening and closing a door and footsteps, you
carpets still haven't arrived, have they?
That'd be awful.
It always amazed me at how little carpeting was used in the old days, because everything was footsteps.
Yeah, well, of course, it has to be. You've got to be able to
paint
a sound.
Well, that's the only way you can convey movement from one place to another.
Sure.
Are you going to go back to your gangster roles again now, Larry, or are you going to
try
to avoid that?
This format doesn't lend itself too much to gangsters as we
know
them.
Well, you know, heavies, let's say.
No, they're not heavies. Most of the roles on, if you're playing a lead, are sympathetic rather than the villainous type. Both shows that I've done have been psychological dramas. You know, the stream of consciousness and the imagination running wild, et cetera, et cetera. But they're pretty normal, average Joe America, you know. Mm-hmm.
Are there any new faces in the crowd for you? Any new actors who have never really done radio drama before?
Yeah, I would say so, Dick. They weren't quite as facile, shall I say, about the medium as those of us who had done it for 20 or 30 years. But an actor is an actor, I always say. And if you can act, you can do it in any medium. What difference whether it's radio, television, theater, or movies?
You know, one of the most popular programs, and the one that we keep getting requests for, is Inner Sanctum. And you mentioned earlier, Larry, that Hi Brown was the producer of this show. We have an excerpt featuring you. I don't know how far back this goes, but you're playing the part of a young husband, you're on your honeymoon, and the title of this Inner Sanctum adventure is called Till Death Do Us Part.
Inner Sanctum Mysteries. Good evening, friends. This is your host of the Inner Sanctum, Welcome through the squeaking door. Well, I hope you've spent a nice, quiet week building up your nervous system. You're going to need plenty of red corpuscles to digest tonight's gory little dish. Hmm? What's that? Oh, you'd like to have a recipe. To a small quantity of apprehension, add a pinch of dismay, and cook on a slow fire, adding dread and panic in appropriate quantity. Then throw in a dose of terror and a whiff of horror and make it boil, brother. How would you like to go on a honeymoon? Well, you're going on one whether you like it or not, because tonight's story is called Till Death Do Us Part. It's an original radio play by Emil Tepperman. And our stars tonight are Ann Shepherd and Larry Haynes. Just look at them. Joe and Nancy Page, married hardly 5 hours, and parked at the side of the road by the bank of the old mill stream, and whispering sweet nothings to each other, living in a fool's paradise.
Oh, gee, Nancy, it's wonderful to be married to you.
Oh, darling.
Gosh, baby, I hope you don't mind spending a honeymoon in a tourist cabin instead of a swanky hotel.
Oh, I love it this way. The stream rushing past, the moonlight shining on the bridge, and the woods all around. Joe, look, there's another car. They're parking on the bridge.
Uh-huh. Well, he's turning his headlights out, too. You think they've got privacy? Guess they can't see us parked here.
Joe, look. That couple's getting out of the car.
Yeah. We're walking the bridge, I guess.
Hmm?
Wonder if this is their wedding night, too.
Oh, that's a gorgeous couple. Joe?
What?
That couple, they're acting very strange.
They're having an argument.
Joe! Look, look what he just took out of his pocket.
Holy mackerel. A gun.
He's pointing the gun at her. Joe! He shot her in the face.
Holy mackerel. It can't be. It must be a gag of some kind.
She used to have the flashes when he fired the gun. And see how still she lies. Her body crumpled at his feet.
Yeah. He's picking her up. I bet he's going to throw her in the...
Nancy,
you pushed my hand down on a horn. He sees us.
He's coming across the bridge.
Heading for us.
What?
He knows we witnessed the murder. He's got to kill us, too.
Well, quick, grab the car.
Stay here before I can turn the car around.
Then what do we do?
Oh, we'll duck into the woods. Come on. Quick. Let's run.
My high heels, I can't run
you
fast.
You've got to. Here, through these bushes. Get behind this tree.
He's getting out of his car. Joe, he has the gun. He means to kill us.
He's coming straight for this tree. Oh. He knows we're here. Nancy, we've got to run for our lives. Here, take my hand. Come on.
Get us.
Run, Nancy. Faster. Here's the road. Let's stop.
I never thought we'd make it. Is he still after us? Coming through the woods?
I don't know. We'll stop the first car that comes along.
Oh, Joe.
Oh, now take it easy, baby.
I was just thinking of that poor girl lying dead on the bridge.
Our wedding night, too. Here comes the car. I'll stop it.
It isn't stopping.
He went right by.
Joe.
What?
A car is there. With our marriage license in the glove compartment and the receipt Mrs. Swenson gave us for the cabin.
Yeah. He'll know all about us. Who we are, where to find us.
And we don't know a thing about him except his face. The face of a murderer.
Come on, Nancy. I think we better start walking. We've got to get to the cabin and phone the police.
How much further, Joe?
Just around the bend.
Oh, I'd like to lie down and sleep right here on the road.
Fine way to spend a wedding night.
Darling, look.
Hmm?
We're there. Swenson's cabin.
Uh-huh.
See, they're all dark. Everybody's asleep.
We'll wake up Mrs. Swenson. Use her phone.
Joe.
What's the matter?
Look in front of our cabin.
What? Hey. That's our car.
The murderer must have come here by another road to wait for us.
I don't see anybody around.
Maybe he's in the car.
Wait here. I'll go and see.
No, no, Joe, you'll see him.
No, don't worry. We both saw his face. He's got to kill us both. Don't you see, baby, if I go over there alone, he won't choke till he knows where you are.
But, Joe...
Now, take it easy, will you? You stay back here in the shadows. It'll be all right. It's okay, Nancy. Car's empty.
Maybe he's hiding somewhere close by.
No, no, he must have skipped out.
But why did he bring our car back?
Well, he wanted to get away from the bridge. Don't you see, he must have dumped that girl's body in the river, and then he took our car away. No trace.
Joe, I'm scared. Maybe he's hiding inside the cabin waiting for us.
No, it'd be a sap. One shot would wake up all the people in the other cabins, Mrs. Swenson, too. You know, he'd never get away with it. Come on, we're going in our cabin. We'll get cleaned up, then we'll use the phone. The switch is right here. There. See? There's nobody hiding. Holy mackerel.
What is it?
Over there, on the bed.
What?
The girl's body, with her face shot away, just like we saw on the bridge.
That's a frightening story. I wish we could play more, but we just don't have time. Larry Haynes, you certainly are a versatile actor. You've been successful in radio and television, and now you have a new movie coming out.
Yes, I did a film last winter under very harrowing circumstances. It was bitter cold, and most of the movie were exterior shots on location. The film is called The Seven Ups, and it's produced by Phil D'Antoni, who did The French Connection, and Bullet. And
it's got to be a hit.
we hope so.
Well, Larry, you have a great career behind you, and I'm sure that there are many new challenges for you on the horizon, and I want to thank you so very much for being our guest tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio. I have looked forward to you in particular for a long time.
Boy, can I take you to lunch? Thank you.
And until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
You've been listening to the Golden Age of Radio with Dick Bertel and radio historian Ed Corcoran. A monthly program of radio nostalgia presented by WTIC. Be sure to hear our next broadcast Wednesday, March 20th at 9:05, when our guest will be star of screen and television E.G. Marshall. With the engineering and technical assistance of Bob Schirego and Fred Pearson, the Golden Age of Radio is edited and produced by Brian Hartnett. This is Bill Schofield.
Pepper Young's Family. The story of your friends, the Youngs, is brought to you by Camay, the mild beauty soap for a smoother, softer complexion.